Support for the show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Welcome to the Prop G Pod's Office Hours. This is the part of the show where we answer your questions about business, big tech, entrepreneurship, and whatever else is on your mind. If you'd like to submit a question, please visit officehours.propgmedia.com. Again, that's officehours.propgmedia.com. First question.
Professor Galloway, big fan of a lot of the work that you've been doing over the past year on a lot of the content you've been producing. My question involves around what I think has become one of your favorite companies, Peloton. Recently, they brought in McKinsey & Company and did so very publicly, which is not normally the case when that firm comes in to help. I'm just curious on what your thought is of making such a public matter of bringing in a company that's normally very secretive about the work they do. And second, what your thought is on bringing in a company that also has been embroiled in a lot of its own scandal in the past year. Thanks, and looking forward to hearing.
Thanks, Carter from Chicago. So Peloton hired McKinsey in January to review its cost structure and potentially eliminate jobs as the pace of revenue and subscription growth has slowed significantly from pandemic highs. According to CNBC, revenue grew just 6% year on year in the quarter ending last September compared to a 250% increase in the same quarter in 2020. It's kind of odd to say that. There's a lot of companies that would be happy with 6% growth, but those companies are traded incredible multiples of revenue as Peloton was. It's all about expectations. Anyways, Peloton shares ended 2021 down about 76%. Think about that. I thought it was 80%. Anyways, down a lot. So for some of the context on McKinsey's troubles that you referenced, McKinsey settled lawsuits, I think, for about $500 million last year over its role in the opioid crisis as an advisor to Purdue Pharma. Jesus Christ. The firm has also paid $15 million in the past few years to the U.S. Department of Justice over conflicts of interest and bankruptcy cases. They were involved with, I think they were involved with Gaddafi. I mean, they're just sort of advising some of the, you know, the weirdest fucking people and helping companies make really bad decisions. But here's the thing. They help a lot of companies make a lot of decisions. And it's very easy to be cynical about McKinsey. I've spent the majority of my professional career renting my brain to people in companies. A lot of companies publicly bring in McKinsey because what they're saying is we want outsiders to come in and validate our decisions or specifically help us think through thoughtfully what our pivot should be and how we cut costs and also kind of outsources some of the decision-making. I think that doing it publicly makes a lot of sense. McKinsey, BCG, Bain, these are all amazing businesses. They have grown much faster than the market. So the ability to come in a very thoughtful and rigorous way, try and answer questions with a data-driven approach, with a ton of benchmarking, looking at what other companies are doing, and then some emotional distance, the ability to say, I'm not emotionally involved here. I'm not politicized. I'm not trying to kiss the CEO's ass, although that can't happen in consulting firms. But I found, and I've worked with the CEOs or the CMOs of 34 of the 100 largest consumer companies in the last decade. A lot of times you're just validating what they already know, but they're just too goddamn close to it. Or you're coming in and you're just sort of stating the obvious, but you're stating it and you don't know the politics around stuff. So you just say, yeah, your acquisition, hey, Unilever, your acquisition of Dollar Shave Club for $1 billion, that was just stupid. You know, what are you thinking that all of a sudden overnight you're going to start doing, you know, direct to consumer on shampoo? I mean, what was the point here? Or just benchmarking the shit out of the best Instagram feeds and trying to suss out what are the underpinnings. I think consulting is not only a great career, but I think organizations that bring in outsiders to ensure they're not being too insular is a great idea, as evidenced by the fact that consulting firms continue to grow. Has McKinsey bought its own rep and maybe needs some help at a senior level, like board members who go, no, don't work with fucking Gaddafi, or okay, what are the externalities here of working with a company that is sort of increasingly directly linked with 100,000 graves every year, specifically the opioid crisis? It feels as if they lack some fiduciaries that just have some perspective on the board to go, you know, what are we thinking? We shouldn't take this business. Investment banks have operating committees that have to approve every IPO. I don't get a lot of the decisions. Like, I do not understand the decision an investment bank would make to take Robinhood public. I think Robinhood is bad for the markets, bad for young men, bad for the planet. But some very high-profile investment banks made the decision to take them public. Anyways, public statements about consultants, I think that makes sense. And in this case, it just says we're serious. We're bringing in third-party validation. It's all about brand. McKinsey is kind of seen as a gold standard here. Just as entrepreneurs brag about Goldman taking their company public, big CEOs will pay a premium. And if it's a tiebreaker, unless Bain or BCG have real specialty or real human capital around a specific sector, people usually opt for McKinsey. But I'm a big fan of consulting as a career. I think it makes sense for companies to hire consultants. I'm talking my own book because I've kind of had two consulting firms, Profit and L2. And I think McKinsey, for all the shit they've given, is a fantastic place to start your career. Incredibly interesting, smart, thoughtful people. You want to play tennis with the best players in the world because you raise your own game. So in sum, I'm kind of bullish on consulting. And despite the problems, I'm bullish on McKinsey and think it makes sense for a company like Peloton to bring them in. Probably not the answer you are looking for. Question number two, Dalton from Baltimore.
Hey, Scott, this is Dalton from Baltimore, and I got a question for the dog. Ironically, coinciding with your January 20th Prof G podcast discussing fixing the U.S. higher education system, the Wall Street Journal on the same day released an article saying that Arizona State University is looking to enroll 100 million more students by 2030. It describes this initiative as a free global education initiative that will translate into 40 languages and put online material for 5 business courses. It goes on to say that the program will use machine learning and artificial intelligence to teach and grade, and the courses will confer academic credit as well as lead to a global management and entrepreneurship certificate. I'm curious about your thoughts about this. If you think it's more of just a headline or if it actually has some potential weight behind it, and if you think other academic institutions or even businesses might follow suit, or if you think they'll play more of a wait-and-see approach. Thanks.
Dalton from Baltimore, thanks for the question. This is super interesting. And typically what you hear, you'll get pushback from faculty around how college is about the experience and they need to be more thoughtful. The accreditation institutions, which are the enforcers of the cartel known as higher ed, are totally focused on their PBS metrics, where they look at curriculum and faculty. And basically they want to find their friends who are PhDs from Stanford or Carnegie Mellon, and they want to find this full breadth of curriculum, including things like leadership and ethics, which I think is ridiculous that we think we can teach these things. I can't get my 11-year-old to behave ethically, but I'm going to teach you at 27 how to be ethical around business anyways. We stack it with a bunch of bullshit so we can charge you $250,000 over 4 years. Instead, there's a large population of people who we should be charging $40,000 to get a degree in cybersecurity. The traditional BA is not for everyone. I think it's a wonderful experience. I will be heartbroken if my kids don't decide to do it, but 2/3 of our young people do not end up with a traditional BA. And what's happened is we've decided, or the education industrial complex, or as I call it, Big Ed, has decided to try and create this gestalt that you failed as a parent unless you send your kids to a 4-year college. They have been totally non-innovative. You know, what if Porsche just had the 911 and never introduced the Cayenne? What if Tide just had big boxes of detergent, didn't have Tide Pods? You know, there's just been such a striking lack of innovation. The only thing that's super impressive about universities where they've innovated is they've figured out a way to increase prices 1,400% in the last 30 years, even though inflation's only up 287%, through a rejectionist luxury position. And that's brilliant. But unfortunately, the result is a transfer of wealth of $1.5 trillion from middle-class households to university endowments and faculty or tenured faculty and administrators. What Michael Crow and ASU are doing is absolutely visionary. And that is moving away from this bullshit rejectionist culture and the embrace of big and small tech. Now, whether some of this notion of using the terms AI over and over, whether that's a bit of like clickbait or trying to seem more innovative, whatever, that's fine. I am all for it. I am in, I am down. Anybody who wants to get improve themselves should imagine they live in a place called America where we embrace that, not this bullshit enforcement of an emerging caste system in America called higher ed, where we only let in the children of rich people or the freakishly remarkable. We need to go back to where we were in the 80s, where we let in good kids. You know, they have to have some credentials or they have to have some record of achievement. And even if they don't, give them 2 more years to marinate at a junior college or maybe offer them a degree in health tech or cybersecurity or construction management, whatever it might be. We have to be more innovative here. We have to lower the cost. We have to build more on-ramps into the middle class. That's more vocational funding. In Germany, about 50% of people have some sort of vocational certification. It's less than 10 in the US, and a movement towards figuring out more innovation, more micro-certification, more unbundling, more embrace of big and small tech to bring down the cost and dramatically increase freshman seats. I love this. Jesus Christ, what are they saying? What are they saying? 20 million people that are 100 million people by 2030? Right on, my brothers at ASU. For a little more context on the program, which is set to launch in April, enrollment in the first round of classes will be limited to college graduates, but the university says will include undergraduates in the near future. Credits earned in the program will be transferable to most schools and can be used to pursue a degree at ASU. I've been thinking a lot about what it means to be, I don't know, a better man, if you will. And there's pity. You pity somebody, you feel really sorry for them. I don't think people want our pity. I know I wouldn't want somebody to pity me. There's the next level's empathy. I can relate to your pain. I think that's important. But the next level beyond that is compassion. And that is, I not only can relate to your issues, but I'm going to fucking do something about it. That's compassion. I'm going to move from virtue signaling and highlighting the problem to actually doing something about it. And along those lines, I don't think I've announced this. Anyways, I've given away approximately $15 million of my own money, which is a lot of money for me. I'm wealthy, but I'm not a billionaire, to all public institutions, such as the University of Georgia, where I got to know the dean of the business school there and their law program, which helps lower-income people, to the University of Illinois, that is very committed to expanding their roles. And also, I just gave money to ASU to fund a credential program in supply chain. Why? Because that will be great jobs. And I like the cut of these guys' jibs saying, let's get out of this bullshit. We're not fucking Birkenbags. We are public servants. So I am down with this. Let's reshape public education. And let's all, as individuals, and I'm not good at this, but I'm getting better at it, move from pity onto empathy, and then more than anything, move to compassion. Let's do something about these issues. Your time, your treasure, your talent. Move to compassion. We have one quick break before our final question. Stay with us. Support for the show comes from Betterment. Even the most hardcore of us need to kick back and chill every now and then. But if you're an investor, chill is the last thing you want your money to be doing. You want it to be pumping iron and running marathons for you. If you want your money performing at an Olympic level, you might want to check out Betterment's automated investment and savings app. Betterment's automated technology gives you advanced tools that are built to help maximize returns. Tools like diversified, expert-built portfolios of low-cost ETFs, high-yield cash accounts, and automated investing technology, including automated rebalancing. Plus, Betterment can help with tax-efficient investing. Strategies including their Tax Loss Harvesting Plus and Asset Location can help minimize your taxes and maximize your returns. So whether you're saving or investing, your money should be working as hard as it possibly can for you. Consider Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. You can visit Betterment.com to get started. You can learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. Support for Prop G comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software, including Jira, Confluence, and Trello, help power the collaboration for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, or whether your team is around the corner or on another continent altogether, Atlassian software is built to help keep you all on the same page from start to finish. That way, every one of your teams, from engineering and IT to marketing, HR, and legal, can stay connected and moving together as one towards shared company-wide goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Welcome back. Question number three.
Hi, Prof. G. This is Catherine Wick in Pittsburgh. I'm an architect, and part of keeping my profession going is making sure there's a strong pipeline of students entering the field. There's a tangible shortage of folks in the critical 10 to 15 year experience band as a result of the Great Recession, and I'm concerned about what the future holds in a post-corona world. NPR ran a story this morning saying that college enrollment numbers are down around 1 million this year in the U.S., the lowest number in 50 years. Pair that with the overwhelming number of stories I've read and heard about the Great Resignation, and where do you think this is all heading? Are these two things even related? Which sectors are set to benefit, and which are going to suffer as a result of these two phenomena? Architects are heavily reliant on the sectors we serve, and when those sectors are down, we struggle. Thanks so much, and I appreciate the wisdom. I first heard you on Preet Bharara's podcast, where I thought you gave a remarkably insightful interview, and now I'm a devout Prof. G Pod listener. All the best and stay safe.
Catherine from Pittsburgh, thanks for the thoughtful question. By the way, you should be working for NPR. Specifically, you should be on radio. You have such a lovely voice. From the fall of 2019 to the fall of 2021, undergraduate enrollment at colleges and universities dropped nearly 7%, the largest two-year decrease in 50 years. Community colleges have seen a 13% drop through the course of the pandemic. As for the Great Resignation, or what my podcast co-host Kara Swisher calls it, and I think it's a better term, the Great Reassessment, a study from the Harvard Business Review found that employees between 30 and 45 years of age have had the greatest increase in resignation rates, with the average increase of more than 20% between 2020 and 2021. And last September, Inc. reported that 40% of computer and IT industry employees had already quit or had plans to quit by 2022. At financial firms, that number was 24%, and in the healthcare industry, it was 18%. I wish it'd be fun. It'd be fun to say, well, it's this and it's this. I think this is multidimensional. There's a ton of nuance here. And the honest answer is, I have some ideas, but I don't know. One, obviously the pandemic was an accelerant for existing trends and could argue is the catalyst for this big change. I mean, when you see the earth shifting below you and you know there's an earthquake and it was because a volcano erupted. Okay, that volcano is the pandemic. Now, were the plates due to shift for other reasons? Probably, but the pandemic has done a few things. One, it's dramatically increased the ability to work remotely, which means people can move to lower cost areas, which means they have more opportunities, perhaps not only to make a living by renting their human capital out remotely, but also to lower their cost of living, giving them more options. In some ways, that's a really good thing. I think that something like this creates pause. It's like, okay, do I really want to continue to be working the desk at the Marriott where people are rude to me and I have to put up with the bullshit of asking them to put their mask on and I don't like the school my kids are in and I'm not making that much money. I can go work doing something else in a lower cost town. Also, there's more opportunity in a really strong economy, either to start your own business or to turn on an app and become a DoorDasher or an Uber driver. And those wages have come up. But I think it's a variety of factors. The fact that not as many people are going to architecture, I don't know this, but what little I do know about architects is that they're underpaid. That it's kind of, to be blunt, it's a shitty industry. It's almost like artists. That you go into architecture because it's a passion project. And I know some very talented people who study architecture so they can go make $38,000 a year working for a quote-unquote name brand firm. I think it's a very difficult industry. And I wonder if it'll be good for the industry to have a dearth of architects such that they have more pricing power and there aren't as many of them willing to do great work at mediocre wages. So I think there might be a silver lining here. And that is you might have more currency in the marketplace as a firm that, or as an architect. But I think it is really multidimensional what's going on here, which again is a long-winded way of saying, I don't know. But thank you for the thoughtful question and nice voice, Catherine from Pittsburgh. That's all for this episode. Again, if you'd like to submit a question, please submit a voice recording by visiting officehours.propgmedia.com. Our producers are Caroline Chagrin and Drew Burrows. Claire Miller is our assistant producer. If you like what you heard, please follow, download, and subscribe. Thank you for listening to the Prop G Pod from the Vox Media Podcast Network. We will catch you on Thursday.